That's Exodus chapter 17, and it begins on Pasuk Ches, which is 8. Vayevo Amalek. That is what we read. This parsha we read on the morning of Purim. Now, what's commonly known, this talks about the actual historical event, the occurrence upon which the mitzvah of Zachar is based. The other place is what's called Parsha Zachar, where the mitzvah to remember Amalek and to utterly eradicate the memory of Amalek, that's found in Devarim. Devarim is Deuteronomy, and it's at the end of the Seite, in Devarim chapter 25, and that's verse 17. That's what's commonly referred to as Parsha Zachar. That's what you go to shul. I believe it was 2 weeks ago, to hear Parsha Zachar. We'll do both stories. We'll do both sources, and we'll, you know, raise the pertinent questions, as we always do, see if there's any differences in terms of comparison between one and the other, and so forth. So let's begin with the first one in Shemot. And when does this occur, anybody? When does this event occur? This takes place after the... after Kriyas Yamsuf, after the miracle of the Red Sea, and prior to the giving of the Torah, prior to Matan Torah. Now that's 49, between the time of the Exodus and the giving of the Torah is 49 days, so it takes place very shortly after the, I don't know the exact amount of weeks, but it's within a very short period of the Exodus, within a very short period of the splitting of the Red Sea. And in between are all the events that are described in Beshalach, the murmurings of the Jews, the rebellion, the rebellion about water. In fact, the story right before this is the story about how the Jews rebelled because of the absence of water. But this is only one of a number of rebellions. It's after the manna, the story of the manna, which was another rebellion. And well, now they're camped at Rephidim. So the Jews are camped at a place called Rephidim, and I'm going to go through the story now. Will, I'll ask you, as I always do, to note the problems, what you consider to be the problems, and then I'll tell you what I think they are. I may not answer every question this time, okay? But it doesn't hurt to ask a question. Right? You don't die for a question. It says that Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moshe said to Yoshua, choose for us men and go and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the head of the top of the mountain, and the staff of God will be in my hand. Alright? So Joshua did as Moshe had told him, to fight with Amalek. And Moshe, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the mountain. And it was, when the hands of Moshe were raised, then the Jews would win. But when Moshe rested his hands, when his hands went down, then Amalek would become more powerful. So it seems that obviously this is a major problem. This is one of the main ideas. It seems very strange that funny kind of a war. Here the Jews are going out there fighting, and it says, choose for us Anushim. The term Anushim is men. It implies like real men. So what's a real man? What kind of guy is this? What's a machlokas? One rabbi said it refers to Chachamim, Talmidei Chachamim. And another one said Giborim, powerful one. I'm not going to try and explain what the difference is. I guess the ideal would be both. I don't know why. I don't know, right, exactly. The ideal would be like David. One who would combine both qualities would be a Talmud Chacham and a warrior. But it's strange. So when they're commanded to fight a war, they have to use their own abilities, their own resources and strategies. So strange that a war operates this way through the hands of Moses. What kind of combination is this? What's going on over here? The hands of Moses. Because I'll take up the problem. I'm familiar, you know. They asked that question, and Chiyodos Shal Moshe Ozos Muhammad, do the hands of Moshe's hands have the power to conduct the war? The whole thing is strange. But anyways, there was a problem, because he could not keep his hands up the whole time. After all, Moshe was human. He was a very powerful individual, as we've seen, but he was human, and his hands got tired. Yeah. So it needed an so the they needed an Aser. And the hands of Moshe were very heavy. So they took a stone and placed it beneath him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. And thus his hands were true until the setting of the sun. So they solved the problem. You know, it's very important to be innovative even in one battle. You can't foresee every contingency. And you have to be innovative. And Yahushua smote Amalek and his nation by the sword. So they won the war. But let's stop. Are there any other questions to this point, aside from the obvious question about the hands of Moshe, which is one of the main ideas in Shir? Is that it? If you study closely, close analysis, are there any further questions? To mention it tangentially, it's not too far back. If you read how the Jews, when they saw the Egyptians coming after them by the Red Sea, and they were totally paralyzed, they couldn't lift a finger, they couldn't fight, they couldn't mount any kind of defense. And then they complained to Moshe, we'd be better off, were there not enough graves? You know, Jewish humor even then. Were there not enough graves in Egypt? You took us out to be killed there? And Moshe said that you just stand and watch. And God, Hashem Yilachem Lachem, God will fight for you. So you see that they were totally incapable of fighting. How is it possible? How is it possible that in so short a time they were able to fight against a major power? I don't know that I'm going to take that up today. I've answered that question, but we'll just keep it. I have other points I want to take up today. Well, we're going to do Parshas Zohar too, so we'll compare the two. Oh, that's a good question, but I think I can answer it. The only other... I'm sorry.
Everybody wipes them out, they children as well.
Right. That's the answer.
The
entire nation wasn't situated. He had just... Yeah. As Paro. Paro didn't have the old Mitzrayim there. He just had an army. And they had come out from where they dwelled. They dwelled in the Negev. They lived in the Negev. So in order to eradicate the entire people, the Jews would have had to go through the Sinai to the Negev, and they weren't prepared at this point to do that. They just defeated the group, the army, the expeditionary force. It just seems a little bit strange. Let's assume we understand the role of the hands of Moshe. But didn't Moshe anticipate that his hands would get tired? And why didn't he prepare for it? It doesn't seem like it would have been such a difficult thing to anticipate that his hands would get tired, and he thus could have prepared a chair to sit on to begin with. It seems that Moshe went out, and he knew it. He had planned. This was a plan. Moshe had thought it out because he said tomorrow. So when Amalek came, apparently they had scouts or whatever. They had at least one day's notice. They had enough time to prepare. Now, that's when he told Yahushua to prepare. And he prepared. His preparation was with prayer. Go up on the mountain with the staff of God. And his hands aloft. It seems that the idea of supporting his hands came only as an adjustment. It was something that they hadn't anticipated. Now, why would they have anticipated? And also to give him something to sit on. To give him something to sit on. So, why didn't he prepare for that? It just seems a little bit strange. I mean, I'm not saying it's a major difficulty. A day? Rashi says on verse 12. Take a look. You have Rashi there in verse 12. Because Moshe was, so to speak, lazy with a mitzvah, and he appointed another one in his place, his hands became heavy. But it doesn't tell you what it's talking about. It doesn't tell you which mitzvah. It can't be the mitzvah of... this mitzvah over here. Flame shot is, if you want to know the flame shot is his hands became tired, because how long can you keep your hands up? So Rashi is trying to teach us something also. It's another aspect. But again, you got to stick with the flame shot. Sorry.
Well,
Rashi points out, though, that That he wants to hang. They didn't. He didn't sit. It says they placed a stone, but he wouldn't sit on a on a comfortable chair. He wouldn't do that. He said Israel is steeped in suffering. Tsar, at the time of Tsar, I too will be with them in Tsar. That's an interesting idea. It was brought up the last year that when great calamities occur, a person, even if a person is not directly involved, like when Israel is at war, we lived through, right? We weren't involved, but I mean, at the time, I'm sure you all remember certain wars that Israel's been involved in, the Yom Kippur War, or for some of us, the Six-Day War. But Jay said that a person should not go off on vacations and just enjoying himself. Just not even before, aside from the fact that Israel was in danger, just for the fact that it's a calamitous phenomenon for the world at large. We care about humanity, what happens to humanity, and we shouldn't disassociate ourselves. That's cruelty. That's a lack of identification. So when there's great famine or there's great suffering in the world, so a person should minimize his own comfort. He should identify. You should identify with it. You see that on the, I know what you're referring to. You're referring to the Noah, when he got off the,
I was going to say, even when we were with Moshe for 30 days.
Another question is, and I don't know that I'm going to be able to answer it. It just states in Pasuk Ches, I'll throw this out to you. You don't have to answer me right now. It just says that Amalek came, as though we know who Amalek is. Isn't it a little bit strange? In describing the war, it doesn't give us any background as to why he came. It doesn't tell us at all about who he was and why he came and what he is. Ah, well, I'm just raising it as a question. In the case of Egypt, you know why they came out after the Jews. But here you don't. No, you haven't been, well, not at this point, just as Amalek came. As though we already know about Amalek. Where do we know? We haven't heard about Amalek. Okay, I'm just mentioning that as it's a problem. Now now let's continue. Then it's like this. Then God said to Moshe, write this down in a book and place it in the ears of Yoshua. In other words, teach it to Yoshua. By the way, Chazal points out that this is a remez. Here God hinted to Moshe that he would not lead the Jews into the promised land. For I will surely erase the memory of Amalek from beneath the heavens. And Moshe built an altar, and he called the name of the Mizbeach, Vayikra Shemo, and he called the name of the Mizbeach, Adoshem Nisi, which means, Rashi says, God has done for us miracles here. Okay? Now Rashi says that's not the name of the altar. You think what Rashi says, not that the altar is named God, except rather the one who mentions the name of the altar will remember the miracle that that God did for us over here. All right, so he built an altar, and the purpose was to serve as a remembrance for the miracle. And he said, for the hand is on the throne of God. In other words, it's a euphemistic expression. It's as though God takes an oath, so to speak, with his hand over his throne. A war of God against Amalek from generation to generation. Generation to generation. Alright, so obviously this is what what you had in mind, Jackie, this is what clues us off. This war is different, that this is something unique over here. As a result of this war, because normally if someone attacks you, you fight back. The mitzvah of the Torah to fight back against the enemy that comes upon you, and that's it. But we don't see any other situation where the Jews were obligated to continue a eternal war from generation to generation. And moreover, God knew that the actual nation of Amalek would not last historically, would not last past a certain point. Okay. Haman is a descendant of Amalek, true. So Amalek is a concept. Now, Before we move on, are there any other questions pertaining to this parsha? Karen says, "Did you all have a place?" Or Karen 25:17. So it says, "Remember what Amalek did to you, Badera, on the road, the Teshuvah in Mitzrayim when you left Egypt, who encountered you on the road and cut off all the laggards, the weak ones, right? What's the best translation? The tired and weak amongst you, and you were tired, stragglers, and you were tired, you were very tired then and worn out, and he didn't fear God. And it shall be, when God gives you rest from all your enemies from around you, in the land that the Lord your God will give you as an inheritance to inherit, you shall eradicate the memory of Amalek from beneath the heavens. Do not forget." Very powerful. Here's where the mitzvah. Now we're given a commandment. Now, what questions would you ask about this parsha itself, these two psukim, and perhaps anything that seems to be contradictory from the other one? Any questions here?
One is not to forget. One is to eradicate them.
And one is to remember. So, and remembering and not forgetting seem to be the same, but they're two separate things. As the rabbis say, do not forget in your heart. That is not to forget the whole ideas. Remember is verbal. To actually, like Zohar, where else do we see that remembering is verbal expression? By Kiddush. Zohar is Yom HaShabbos L'Kacho, remember. Same term. Which is translated into actual verbalization. That's when we read Parsha Zohar. That's reading Parsha Zohar. The third thing is to eradicate. That there is a mitzvah to eradicate. But I want to... One second. Let me just... On the topic of eradication, there's a condition, and that condition is when God gives you rest. It says, they weren't mechuyot. The Jews did not become obligated in this mitzvah until they had entered the land and had achieved peace. Had fought all the wars until they had achieved peace from all the enemies that had surrounded them, and until they had appointed a king. Which means to say, when... Do you have any idea historically how many years transpired that went by until they actually engaged in the war? They did fight the war. This mitzvah, King Saul, how many years? Were worth about approximately 400 years. Because during the period of the Shoftim, yes, during the period of the Shoftim, they didn't have a melech, a king. And as long as the Jews did not have a king, they did not have the obligation. The obligation came into existence with the first king, and that's why Shmuel commanded him. Shmuel HaNavi commanded him to here it's not mentioned about a king, but that is brought down in the Rambam. I can show you in the Rambam. Take a look in the Rambam. This is Torah Shabbat there. What is the significance, though? It's more than just a practical thing, that until they've achieved peace from all the enemies around them, they're not obligated to fight this war. Now, you have a contradiction there, Jackie? With the practical answer that in the first instance the children and the women, the whole nation was not present, and they weren't prepared.
We don't know.
No, but they won. That was a defensive war, by the way. The first war that they fought was not being fought. It's a good point. The first war that they fought was not being fought in the same manner as the second one. The first one was merely a war of self-defense, and therefore they were only obligated in terms of self-defense.
No.
I've been there.
Why didn't they know? I mean, right. It's all type of a concept. They should have known. These are the people that we should have. We didn't need a mitzvah to do
that. Well, I can answer you in two ways. That first of all, had Amalek not gone out and attacked them, then they wouldn't have been a Kam Amalek in the first place. No, it's a Chamas mitzvah in terms of self-defense. But had Amalek not attacked them, assuming Amalek had free will, then this entire parasha of Zohar would not have come into being. That was the act which defined them as Amalek, correct? Let's assume that they would not have come out to attack them. Then the whole picture could have been different. I don't know how God would have... The concept of Amalek seems to be one which exists from day one, from creation. But how it would have set itself up, I don't know. But the point is that the first war that they fought was not by its nature a Melchamas Amalek. It was a defensive war. However, isn't it interesting? Let me point out this question. Both parshios speak about eradicating Amalek, but in two different ways. That's a hint. seems to be a contradiction. In the first parasha, it says, Ki mocho emcha, I will. God is promising the Jews that I will eradicate the memory of Amalek. In the second one, it doesn't say that God will. It says you, Timcha Zeh Hamalek. You should wipe out the memory of Amalek. Which, at least on the surface, seems to be a contradiction. Malki? In Parshas Zohar, God is telling you, he's giving you the command to remember. And in giving you the command to remember, he's telling you what it is you're supposed to remember, what Amalek did to you. Now, what did he do to you? He encountered you on the way and cut off all the stragglers amongst you who were behind, the weak ones, and you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. That's not mentioned, by the way, in the first case. It is not mentioned in the first story. It's mentioned in Zohar. We are learning that Amalek didn't just, you know, attack the Jews head on, but he looked for the weak ones first. That he was very sneaky. And he went after the stragglers. They must, like, the Jews were a nation traveling through the wilderness. There's not everybody sticks together there, the slow ones, the weak ones, and he looked for the stragglers. What? He mentioned that you were tired and weary. Now, what were they were tired from it? The Mefarshim point out, aside from, I'm not going into the idea of Aveira because they're there, but physically. The fact is that they were weary. They didn't have water. They hadn't had water. They didn't have water to drink. They were tired from the journey. They were in a very worn out, haggard, physical state. Let's leave it at that. What's problematic about this? The Lord. The problem about this is, I can understand why we have to fight against the Amalek because of what they did, because they attacked us. And then we'll get into that. And because of that, they're wicked and they're evil. But given that, why does it add to the remembering? Why does it add to the evil, the fact that we were tired and weak? I mean, once, if you're going to, and that they attack the weak ones first, or the stratagems that they use, if you're going to attack, of course you're going to. How does it make them any different? Any nation that's going to attack you for whatever reason is going to look to for their best advantage, for their own side. So, I mean, are they any the worse for the fact that they attack the stragglers, or that they attack the weak? That's all. Seems to be like I don't see the relationship in terms of Zohar. It's not even mentioned, by the way. It's not mentioned in the original story. In the original story, it says he came out by Yavam Malik. He came to fight with you. And it doesn't mention this thing that he attacked the weak one. Now we learn that he did. In terms, I don't see that it adds to the significance of Amalek, or to our need to remember and eradicate Amalek because of the way he conducted war. Of course, once you go to war, I mean, when the Israeli army, any army, even in a just war, when you have to fight a just war, then you seek to go about it in the way that's best for you. You're going to attack the weakest link, right? You're going to attack the weakest link. You're not going to endanger yourself. I mean, that's, why is this so terrible? Why is this so terrible? That's alluded to in the term Ashakarpa. Yeah. Of course, who encountered you, and one of the pshatim that Rashi says is that it's an expression of coldness, kar, which means that he came to cool you off. In other words, if you read through the Shira, it says that the entire world was quaking with fear because the word had gotten out that the Jews were able to escape from Egypt, and most especially the miracle of the Red Sea. So this, when word spread, people had a tremendous fear of the Jews. And alright, Chaita Sunday spoke about the whole concept of Amalek and the whole idea, you know, what Amalek really represents. It's an ideological phenomenon, and it's the phenomenon, it's the glorification. It's basically the deification of a certain group of people. When people are involved in self-deification, so it's an inevitable phenomenon that they're going to hate the Jews, because the Jews represent the deification of God and the fact that man is really nothing. That man is really nothing but a servant of God. So, at that time, this is what the Jews represent to the entire world. And we noted, by the way, Rachid made the point, but we noted also in the case of Shemos, the overestimation that unconsciously there's always this tremendous fear of the Jew. Overestimation of the power, like Pharaoh was afraid the Jews are going to take over, which wasn't true. It was all in his own mind. And all anti-Semites have utilized that idea. Tremendous overestimation of the power of the Jew. At that time, the world was really quaking with fear. That was a very significant moment in history. You have to realize what Amalek did. It was God's objective, and of course, that's Yemos HaMashiach, it'll be realized in the days of Mashiach, that God should be recognized by the entire world. And God didn't create the world just for the Jews, and it will give the Torah just for the Jews. But the objective, and that has to be realized, is for the perfection of the, and that's what we say in Aleinu. L'sakein olam malcha shakai. That the world should be perfected with the kingship of God. That God will rule. The rule of God will be recognized throughout the entire world. And this will come about, of course, through God's instrument, which is the Jewish people. That's the role, that's the historical role of the Jewish people, to perfect themselves as a nation and to maintain the true philosophy of life for themselves and, of course, for the rest of mankind as well. At this was a tremendous opportunity for mankind. If you read the whole Shira, Ozna Mogu, Yoshbe Kanan, that the entire world was really affected. And there was a tremendous awe, a tremendous fear. A tremendous fear of God as manifested in the Jewish people. The Jewish people had a tremendous place in the esteem of all the nations. You see that even in Mitzrayim, it's a Gamayosh Moshe, Gadolhoi Moed, the Jewish people got a place, the Chayim, in the eyes of the Egyptians. Then after the Kriyas Yamsuf, the entire world was quaking with fear. Now Amalek came out to destroy the Jewish people because Amalek wanted to destroy that whole idea, the deification of God. Amalek was basically, I'm sorry? They wanted to destroy that to promote, right, to promote the deification. That's why, like Jackie mentioned before, that's why it says Vayevo Amalek, that Amalek came. It was inevitable. He had to come. There was no other cause. In other words, if you just understand everything that had occurred until that time, so Amalek came out. There was no encounter over here. In other words, it wasn't as though there was a conflict. If the Jews happened to be crossing over their land and there was a conflict over territory, no, Amalek went out of their way. There was a necessity. It was essential. It was essential because their philosophy could not thrive. Their philosophy could not survive. They were completely, it's either them or us. It can't be both. It's a matter of them or us. Yeah. That's exactly what Amalek is. Amalek is where a group is living in accordance with a philosophy of which the hatred of the Jew is an integral component of that. Haman must hate Mordechai. If you understand what Haman is, then Haman is basically involved in a philosophy of the deification of the self, of himself. So then you see that everything was meaningless to him as soon as every time he saw Mordechai, because Mordechai represents, the fact is that he's really nothing. Yeah. Right. To pull them off was to show
any kind of damage.
To break break the aura of invincibility.
Yeah.
In other words, their only motivation in this case was to break the aura of invincibility. The example being like a boiling hot tub, like, you know, no one wants to go in there because it's too hot until somebody goes in there and jumps in and he gets burned. It's true, he gets burned, but in the process of doing so, he cools it off. So now he gives other people an opening, so other people lose their fear. That's what Amalek sought to do. Let's go back for a second. Let's take up the issue of the hands of Moshe. Let's return that to see if we can answer some of the questions. Now let me just give you the quote. Chazal answered the question. Your answer will have to be in line with the answer of Chazal. They asked the question. And they say, can the hands of Moshe perform war? Or lose a war? Win a war or lose a war? But rather it is, this is the answer that you were referring to before. Okay, we're going to try and explain it, though, I mean, in a deeper way. Except it is to say to you that as long as the Jews were looking heavenward and were subjugating their hearts to their Father in heaven, then they would be more powerful. And if not, they would fall. That's the traditional interpretation. That is to say that it's not that the hands of Moshe had any power, but rather, as long as the Jews would subjugate their hearts to their Father in heaven, then they were powerful. They were able to fight. The Jews were able to fight. But when they ceased to do that, then they lost their strength. It still doesn't answer it. I mean, so what does that do with the hands of Moshe? The issue should be, and also, what do you mean? Are you saying then that it was miraculous? That whenever the Jews had these thoughts of subjugating themselves to God, so then God would win for them? Was that a miraculous kind of thing? The Ashkacha was with them? Is that what it's teaching us? Or is there some other kind of an idea over here? You know, Lauren? This, they never fought this way again, did they? This is one could ask that question. I mean, if that's the proper way to fight a war, then why don't they fight subsequent wars like that? It's only a one-time thing. This is the only time they fought that way. Afterwards, they did not. Afterwards, when they fought, they didn't have this phenomenon of the hand.
They didn't have it by Shaul either.
Right, they fought in the normal. I mean, first you pray, of course, the Kohen. We do have the phenomenon of the special Kohen that addresses the people before war. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. But this case was different. Okay, good. Question. With reference to something that we've mentioned before. With reference to the fact that, remember we said before that it's strange that only a few weeks before this event, the Jews were totally incapable of fighting. They were completely overcome by fear. Right? They saw the Egyptians running after them, and they were totally paralyzed. Totally paralyzed. They could not mount any kind of a defense. And here, you know, Yoshua chooses men, and they put together an army, and they can fight. Now, how is it possible? What took place? Now, to make a long story short, I don't want to go through the whole Inya and the whole Shira again. The Shira. That was a very significant development. The Jews were caught up in a slave mentality when they left Egypt. And the real idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the real idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, in my opinion, the Exodus was not complete. I mean, aside from, of course, giving the Torah. But the Exodus per se, the removal from Mitzrayim, was not complete until the Kriyas Yamsa, until the splitting of the Red Sea. Because the Exodus was not just the physical removal from Egypt, that's not freedom. But they had to free themselves from a slave mentality. Now the essential feature of that mentality is the overestimation of the power of the master. You find that in every slave situation. And if a person can't outgrow that, then he's always a slave. And you see other peoples that were slaves, that were enslaved. When one people is enslaved another, the fact that they gain political freedom, like in America, the blacks have gained political freedom, but they're still affected tremendously by that whole slave mentality. It's a complete lack. I mean, they try and deny it. They try and deny it by going to a radical extreme. That's nothing. It only proves that the mentality is there. And it's overestimation of human mind. It's overestimation. That's exactly what the Germans tried to instill the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, tried to instill in the Jews. They tried to instill in them that sense of invincibility, the aura of invincibility. It's the worship of human might. So the Jews were caught up in that too. But God understood that it was impossible, given what they had just gone through, the 210 years of enslavement, that they would have that ability to stand up against the Egyptians. That's why God said, just watch. You just watch and see. When God, the reason why they broke out in Shira, and why it goes into the Lord, God is a man of war, and glories in God's ability to fight. We have no tradition of glorification of battle. What they're really singing about, was that they completely free themselves from the concept of human might. They lost that whole overestimation of human right, and they realized that was the whole amazement, that which they thought was so powerful was purely in the mind, purely in the imagination. The only power is God. That's why it goes into a very detailed description, the way the chariots, horse and chariots went down, all these tremendous weapons were like nothing, falling apart. It's like unbelievable, they couldn't believe it. Which means to say
that they saw it. That's why it says they saw the Mitzrayim mace al Sfat Hayam by Amir Bar Hashem. They saw the Egyptians dead on the beach, by the shore, on the shore, and they believe in God and in His servant Moshe. Why did they believe? Because the essential avodah zarah, the essential idolatry, is the worship of human life. And they had become liberated. And once you're liberated from that, the same thing occurred. You read the stories of the Holocaust in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Jews had been so intimidated by the myth of Germany, the whole world. It wasn't just the Jews, the whole world was how was Hitler able to take over nations? France fell, Poland fell, nations fell in days they fell. They could fight. But the point of it is, if you understand psychology, that once you've defeated the people psychologically, you've given them the sense that it's hopeless. Until somebody comes along and stands up. And that's the Jews held out longer in the Warsaw Ghetto than the whole Poland resisted against the Germans when the Germans attacked Poland. And you read the diaries that survived. The Jews fought back out of desperation. At this point, they were just a band, and then a lot of them were just kids, teenagers, I mean, boys and girls, just to put together makeshift kind of weapons. And when the Germans came in with their huge tanks and armored vehicles and so forth, and they threw a Molotov cocktail, they shot a few pretty guns, and they saw the Germans that had been wounded were screaming and they're yelling, just like that's what turned the tide. They saw that they bleed too, the day died too. That gave them a whole new sense of strength. They were able to really make life miserable for the Germans. Until, of course, what they wound up doing was just blowing up building after building after building. They couldn't defeat them any other way. That's why they were able to fight against the Amalek. If they had not witnessed the destruction of the Egyptians in the Yom Suf and the Red Sea, they wouldn't have been able to fight. But once that emotion of the worship of human might was removed, now they just looked at them totally different. They're just people. And if we use our strength, if we use our intelligence, and of course if we have faith in God, everything in this world, of course, is ultimately dependent upon God. If I live in accordance with God's will and I do what God wants me to do, then that's it. There's nothing to be afraid of. And then they were capable of fighting. But I would say one thing, that the war against Amalek was a transitional stage. God wanted them to internalize that idea. Once you've internalized that idea, then you're capable of functioning independently. And you'll have enemies, but you'll never be overawed by everything. The Torah, the Kohen comes out before they go to war and he reads the portions of the Torah. Do not fear, different expressions of fear. Don't be afraid of everything they do. There's psychological warfare and so on and so forth. Just remember the Lord your God goes before you to fight for you. If you remember these basic ideas about the ultimate truth, then you'll never be afraid to go to war. You'll be able to overcome your fears. You'll be able to fight.
One second.
But at this particular point, I would say that the Jews had not fully reached the level of internalizing those ideas, but these ideas are very much dependent upon the image of Moshe Rabbeinu. They needed the image of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because, apparently, yes, apparently when they saw, it's in the same way, that's why I mean it's very important to you, it's the mitzvah of the Torah. It says, Uvo Sidbuk, to cling to God. And how do you fulfill the mitzvah of clinging to God? To be medavik, to cling to Talmidei Chachamim. That's why it's a mitzvah. Actually, to marry one's daughter to a Talmid Chacham, or to marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham. And so in other words, to do business with Talmidei Chacham, to set up all types of relationships which ensure that you keep in touch in all social situations, in all kinds of situations, to Talmidei Chacham. Because through them, you're always in contact with the true way with Torah. You're always involved in a life of Torah. But not just in the life of Torah, but with people who represent the true ideals. Because that's, until a person reaches a certain level, the abstract ideas are not sufficient by themselves. But it's why part of a person's training is always supposed to involve shimush, to be mashamish Talmid Chacham, to actually serve Talmid Chacham, to go into their house and do their housework for them, do their laundry, whatever it is, because that enables a person to keep in contact with them. to maintain contact. Why? Because the way a person functions, until he reaches a certain level, he can't relate directly to the ideas themselves, but he has to relate to the ideas through the vehicle of a certain ego ideal, a certain person who represents those ideas. That's very, very important. It has a profound effect upon him. Of course, it can be distorted, as it is in Chassidus, in my opinion. You know, you read the article in the New York Times Magazine, in my opinion, and I'm not taking it up right now, I have it with me, but there are a lot of things, you know, that I read in that thing that are very disturbing. I don't believe that's the proper way. That we're intended to relate to an individual, even a great individual. A person, a great individual, a great knowledge. I don't think that's the proper relationship. That's something else. Like anything else, it's got to be done properly. You can, you know, get past the point, and then you become fixated on the person. It becomes a cult of the individual. And that's it's the individual insofar as that individual represents certain truths, and you're really pursuing and trying to internalize the truths and getting further away from the person himself. The person who represents the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now, it seems to me that at this stage of the game, the Jews were capable of fighting, but only in conjunction with the image of Moshe Rabbeinu. But not Moshe the person, because Moshe was Meshabbat himself. That's when they saw Moshe, and they saw Moshe in prayer. The whole idea of standing up with his hands raised in that attitude of prayer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he represented the ultimate in humbleness and in subjugating oneself and the realization of that truth, that the only thing that's real is God, and we have to subjugate ourselves totally to the will of God. When they saw that, so that affected their own heart, and once it effectuated them in that way, when they had that attitude, so they lost their fear of Amalek. And then they fought with tremendous power. But apparently, when that image was not there, when Moshe rested his hand, when Moshe rested his, they were so dependent, at that time, they were so dependent upon the person of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's interesting, it says, V'yamin about Hashem, they believe in God and Moshe Avdo, and they serve Moshe. It doesn't mean they believe in Moshe as a God. But their belief in God was very much dependent upon the person of Moshe Rabbeinu. What we see afterwards, in some cases it went too far, because that's what led them to build the ego, because they saw Moshe was, they couldn't function without Moshe. When Moshe was late, you know, that's the story. Those who made the ego. That Moshe Rabbeinu did not, because my question was, so why didn't he prepare from the start to have his hands up? Right? Yeah. No, but he knew that he had to be up there. You mean he didn't know about this whole phenomenon? That's possible. That is possible that he didn't see the connection. That's a good point. Or it's possible, yes. It's possible. You know, it's possible to say that he realized that they needed this, but that he didn't realize the extent. He felt that if he put his hand down, with him being there and them looking at him, they could internalize it enough so that if he put his hand out, if he rested for a while, it wouldn't cause an immediate change. But you see, he could have been wrong on that point.
But don't you think that what I said also about how God had to demonstrate to
the essential thing over here was not to be afraid of Amalek. You have to realize that in so many things, the mental attitude is most important. No matter how skilled you are, you realize it's not so much, it's not skill, it's that mental attitude. And the most important element in a mental attitude is confidence, self-confidence. Not a crazy kind of conceited, attitude, but a... Right, self-confidence. That's a very important thing to instill. And as for parents and educators, it's one of the most important things. I'm sure if you look into your own self, you realize, very often, you know you can do certain things, or you'll even see other people doing it, and you know you can do it as well, if not better, but you feel you're lacking in the confidence, you know, that self-confidence. And you also see that where you do have that confidence, how easy things are. But the confidence should be based upon reality. It shouldn't be a crazy egotism. That's not the genuine self-confidence. They didn't have that. They had not internalized. What I'm suggesting now, this is my interpretation. And afterwards they did. Because sometimes, let me see if I can give you a mashal. After this war, the Jews had internalized the idea. And it was sufficient for the Kohen to remind, to read to them, that's a more abstract level, where they didn't need the person of Moshe standing there with his hands up. But they did need, which makes sense, of course, to remind themselves by the Kohen reading the Parsha, a separate Parsha of the Muchama, right, the reality. I would say, for example, it could be when you're teaching someone how to do something, or even a child, or even an adult, and the person doesn't have the complete confidence they can really do it. And you're insisting that he can, that he's ready. You know, the first time he's going to, I don't know, ride a bike, parachute from a plane, whatever it may be. And he's been training you and teaching you, and the first time you do it, he has to be there with you. And as long as the coach who's telling you you can do it is with you, as long as you see him there, you can do it. But once you've done it, now you don't need him there anymore. Now you know you can do it. You see, there's a tremendous... The first time is very important. Because in the first time, yeah, mentally you see all... You know, logically you see the reasons why you should be able to do it. But until you actually, right, until you actually do it, there's always the factor of doubt and fear. You have not completely overcome that, put to rest that fear until you go out there and do it. You know, like they say, if a person's in a car accident or whatever, and he's afraid to drive, get back, make sure they can, you know, get him back in there as soon as possible. Right? Because the longer you wait, that fear develops. So, this was the first time, the abstract knowledge that there's no such thing as human might. And it's only the will of God that counts. And therefore, we should have the courage to fight. That abstract idea, they were not ready to put into action at this point without the person of Moshe Rabbeinu. They needed the person of Moshe Rabbeinu. Afterwards, so this was the transitional phenomenon. And that's why they needed Moshe Rabbeinu. Let me just hold on my question as well. I don't want to just tie it up now. Now, what else did we say? We have Kimacha Lamcha, I will,
right.
And you will, right, that's one question. What's the... Okay, right. And, what is the importance of this mitzvah? This is a very important mitzvah. We're given a command to fight this war. God has declared a war against the Amalek from generation to generation. And Timcha, we have to be involved in that war. Now, philosophically, why is that so important? What is the basis for it? Why is this war so important? Then why must we engage in this war? And in line with this, I'll see if we can answer. I don't know if I can, but I'll try and answer that question of why in Zohar it mentions about the fact that he attacked the Tide War, the weak one. Jackie, let's check. Now, this war. Okay. Sefer HaMitzvot talks about the mitzvah to love God, and he says that this mitzvah of loving God includes that we should call out to people to the service of God and to believe in God. And it's just like when you love a person, so you can't prevent yourself, you can't always go back from telling everybody, but it's prelude. And you want to tell other people about this person and get other people to like him. So too, when you have a true appreciation of God, a true love of God, it includes your desire to make God's name known and praised throughout the world. So I would say this is, in other words, that's what God is saying. That's the promise, that the throne of God is incomplete. The throne of God is incomplete in the world. That's why it says Kiyot Al Kase. The letter Aleph is missing from Kisei, which Chazal say, because my throne will not be complete as long as Amalek is successful. So, therefore, I would say that you can't be a fence sitter. A person that truly loves, you can't have, like a lot of people have the attitude, you know, I'm religious, but I mind my own business. You know, like live and let live kind of thing. I respect the other person too.
That has no basis. This live and let live is really total indifference. What it means to say is that you just do what you really don't care, and you don't really understand it, but you do it because of whatever, you know, social reasons or tradition, whatever it may be. But it's impossible. A person that truly believes in God and a person that truly has a love of God has to be a fighter. If a person doesn't care about Chil Hashem, that God's name is desecrated, if he can stand by and tolerate that, then he's absolutely lacking in terms of his love of God. This war must be fought. See, this war must be fought. And it's from generation to generation. Because it's not just that particular people. There's going to be this philosophy of Amalek exists in the world. There's always going to be a group of people that are out for their own, for the deification, for the philosophy, the ideology that is only human, that man is the ultimate force in the universe. And they want to assume that mantle of deification. Whether it's the Nazis in one generation, it's a different group.
Yeah, why don't we have more of an outbreak?
Okay. We should. There are those who speak. Well, the point is you have to, you know, use your seichel, because he's just in a... you have to know when to attack someone. It may be not to give him attention at this point, you know, or even David Duke. You have to know. I mean, there's a lot of nuts out there, but when there's a movement, I mean, we're talking about Amalek, when it assumes the proportions of a movement and it becomes dangerous, then you have an obligation. Now, I just want to mention, why did it say, this thought just occurred to me before the Shia. I was working on this idea. Why is it mentioned in Zachar? In the story of the war itself, it doesn't mention anything about attacking the weak ones, the tired ones. When it says that you should remember, it mentions in that pasuk, remembering that he came out, right, the Atta, and he smote the stragglers, the weak ones, and you were tired and weary. Any thoughts now, as far as what is that? So what? I mean, that's not the essence of why we're fighting Amalek. It would seem to dilute the whole thing. It seems to, right, you should, like a personal thing, you know, that's not what we're fighting against Amalek. We're fighting against Amalek because Amalek came out to destroy what we represent, and we represent the concept of the deification of God, the true God. We represent the God of reality. So why bring in over here? It's irrelevant how he treated us. You would think the Torah would leave that out. It seems to take away, to diminish. We're not fighting for personal. As a matter of fact, that's why it says, when are you to engage in this war? When, plenty of time, when you first have a lust, when you enter the land, and when you're settled, when you establish a kingship, a long time later, 400 years later, which goes to show you that this war that you're fighting is purely ideological. No nation fights 400 years later to settle a grievance from 400 years ago. Because they attacked us in the wilderness 400 years, but this time, 400 years later, we're way past that. It's a whole new situation, and no one's going to care. We're fighting purely for ideological reasons. But I would say, what does it show you about him? I was thinking like this. What is the mark of Amalek on the practical level? I mean, you know, there's the element of absolute cruelty. What is the mark of a Jew? There are three signs, it says. Rachmanim, it says, Baishanim Vagom Lechaisanim. But I would say, of the three, it says, where do you see it singled out? That the mark of the Jew is Rachmanim. By the Givonim. Remember by the Givonim? The Givonim had a grievance against the Jews because Shaul killed out Nob, which supplied them, whatever it is. And David tried to, they wanted certain people to be executed. And David tried to pacify them with all different, and they refused. They refused to be pacified. They wouldn't forgive. They weren't from the Jews. They didn't have compassion. And the mark of the Jew is compassion. There's one character, and that's what the Ramban says. Because we know that we don't believe that goodness resides in any particular emotion, and even, I'll show you another connection in a second. Any emotion, even Rachmanis, if it's misbelieved, we don't believe that Rachmanis is an absolute. No emotion is an absolute because
Shalikol Amarachim Al Achzor. If you wait to see another example, this is very indirect, voracious. We read Yamim Noroyim. Hint that Rachmanis is the real mark of the tzaddik. God tested Abraham. What did he test? Now a test always means your knowledge, your ability over the emotion. Which emotion? The emotion of mercy, of compassion. Or Yitzchak. And why? And that's what it is when we say in the prayer, V'chovash Rachamav, he conquered his mercies. The test of Avraham was he was able to conquer his mercies, because for the most perfected person, that's the most powerful emotion. I mean, in us, if God wanted to test us, he would test other emotions. Certainly that's not our most powerful emotion. But for the tzaddik, the closer you are to God, what? No, of course he is. I'm saying, but that's not his most powerful emotion. No, I don't know. All right. But the point is, that is the mark of the Jew. That's why they try and slander us today. They try and make it seem, and it's, we should fight against the slander. We should fight against this slander. That's why they try to make the Jew, the Israelis, they call the Israelis, that's the word, they call them Nazis. They become just, when they bomb Lebanon, they go into Lebanon, and they bomb, and they say, they claim that they bomb innocent civilians, and they use Nazi-like tactics. That is the worst slander. That is just a projection. Because it's not true, it's all sheker. No army in the world fights the way the Israeli army does, and the truth of the matter is that it's even a question whether you should, halachically, whether they're allowed to, but they actually risk lives. They lost a lot of lives because they went to tremendous extremes not to kill innocent civilians. I know for a fact, I mean, some soldiers in Lebanon, and in many, every case, where they actually were killed by kids, 12-year-old kids, who would pull out a grenade and shoot them, because they were respecting innocent civilian life. They wouldn't just blow up a house. They went out of their way. That's what you should remember. The utter cruelty of a monk. You see that in Hitler. Anyone. See, they claim that it's an ideology. Hitler always claims, that it's an ideology. He wrote books, Mein Kampf, it's a philosophy of life. Don't be impressed by that. It's nothing but hatred. Right? But hatred.
That's the
intellectual. That's the rationalization. You'll always know a monk by the cruelty. And you see that ultimate, that the cruelty that they practice, in the concentration, the extent, the coldness, the extent of the cruelty, innocence, where it wasn't even necessary. It wasn't necessary for any military objective. That's
right.
Amalek. They lost the war. That's right. It hurt them. It hurt them, as we pointed out many times. It hurt them in terms. That was the argument that Esther used, as Rabbi Chase pointed out. How do I know that this is... That he's Amalek, she convinced Achashverosh that he's not doing this for the sake of the king? Because if he really cared about you, then why he would make us into slaves? And we'd be happy to work for you as slaves. This is not going to benefit you. Why did he have to wipe out a whole people? The ultimate cruelty. Exactly. They kill Mordechai. That's why I think you should always remember that. Always remember that the mark of the... A Jew is compassion. Now, it's compassion. The Ramban says that there's one emotion that you should cultivate more than any other. It's compassion, Rachmanis. And even, of course, even there, you have to know how to use your Rachmanis. But by and large, Rachmanis will always lead you in the right direction, unless you're a fool.
Also, the
video
is very subtle. That's why, people can actually buy it without knowing
it's true. Yeah, that's right. And you'll see that Amalek is always cruel, has no compassion whatsoever. And now we have only, what's the, in one place it says, Kimacho Emcha, that I will, and, what is the relationship over there between the two? In one case it says, I will wipe them out, in the second case, you will wipe them out. Yeah. I was thinking, Kimacho Emcha is the real cause. That I will. It's because of the existence of God. In other words, that is the ultimate factor which is responsible. It's God. Which means to say, the idea that I created the world, God is the creator, and the creation must achieve its perfection, which is that the throne of God must be complete. So in that sense, it is the idea of God, the idea of God and the love of God, which is the ultimate cause. But Simcha is the command upon you. You see? It's because of that. It's because of this phenomenon of your relationship to God and your love of God. That's why you have Simcha. You have the command. You have to be engaged in carrying it out. See, only the Jewish people can bring this about.
They
only the Jewish people, yes. And there is God can destroy Amalek. God wants to. God can destroy. God can cause them all to perish through a miracle, but it wouldn't achieve anything. It wouldn't achieve anything. It's got to be, in other words, the destruction of Amalek, the purpose is to bring about the recognition of the reality of God. That has to come about through the Jewish people. Because the nations will only discover God through their allegiance to the Jews. That's the function of the Jews. Let us come, let us go to Jerusalem. That's what's going to happen in Yom HaMashiach.
And that's why the
mitzvah
wasn't until Shaul.
Ki beis tefillah yikar l'chol am. That the nations will only discover God through the Jewish people.
No, and that's why it has to was called the Shaul under the first king, because they have to be an established nation recognized by the other nations.
So the point that Laurie is mentioning, that it's only when the nation is established, there is a Jewish nation, and this nation is functioning in accordance with Torah law.
And
the king represents the ultimate perfection of the system. So then you launch the war against Amalek, and then it will have its desired effect, if it's L'shem Shemayim. So,
Tom
says, by the way, that the actual race of Amalek has now been eliminated from the world. Now they've become through assimilation and everything.
It wasn't because of Mordechai, when he got rid of the 10 sons, did that get rid of himself?
He says there aren't any Amalekites left. But Amalek.
The worry of the Duff is because Mordechai got rid of 65,000 of them in Shushan.
Because that is because. That doesn't
mean
that. That does not necessarily mean racial, biological. Well, I don't know if all those who fought with him were necessarily of the same. He was Yizera Amalek.
Right,
he himself.
But that's why putting the answer the second day in Shushan Purim, because
any nation whose hatred of the Jew is not accidental, but it's embedded in their ideology because of what the Jew represents and how that is a threat to what they're trying to achieve, that's Amalek. I would say so.